On the Empire Podcast this week, we get under the skin of Under the Skin director Jonathan Glazer, and we feel the need to talk to Need for Speed star Image Inputs, plus the usual melange of movie news, reviews, and nonsense on the only movie podcast that thinks now he's no longer a master chef that Michelle Rue Jr. should star in True Detective Season 2, and he should team up with a beautiful piece of halibut into the bargain. Am I alone in this?
Maybe a nice saffron sauce with that.
Oh, lovely. Hello, bot. I'm Chris Hewitt, and welcome to the Empire Podcast. Joining me today, once again, are three people who were in here when I walked in, so I might as well do something with them. First up's our Queen Geek, who's been known to dispatch soldier geeks to battle with anyone who doesn't agree with her controversial opinions on the Supernatural Season 7 credit sequence. It's Helen O'Hara.
I don't know what would be controversial.
Because
well,
the
thing that happens with the credits.
With their tops.
Yes.
That happens so little on this show. I've actually been writing in to complain. Supernatural.
Super, I thought you meant this show.
Oh, this show also, yeah. Well, yeah, no, I've been writing in to complain when you do take your top off.
We're constantly shirtless.
The noise you can hear is the unbuttoning of buttons.
Ooh. Next up is our art house guru, a man so steeped in the ways of the subtitle that his favourite REM song is Everybody Herzog. It's Phil Dissemblian. Hello.
Hi, Chris.
All right.
That used to be my favourite REM song. Now it's Radio Free Europa 51. Or What's the Frequency, Kenneth Turan.
Very good.
Thanks.
Last but not least is our trivia buff, a man so dedicated to the art of inane and arcane movie knowledge, he once spent 4 months undercover as a quiz machine down his local pub. It's Ali Plum.
Name three musicals with exclamation marks at the end.
Hang on, I haven't even put 50p into it yet. What's... Are you just...
Ooh.
Hello, Dolly.
Correct.
Oklahoma?
Correct.
Schindler's List?
Oh,
that
no.
was an Interrobang.
Oh. Three movie musicals Ooh. With exclamation marks at the end.
We've got so far Hello, Dolly.
Hello, Dolly.
Fiddle on the Roof.
Oliver.
Correct.
Hey.
Oliver. Other acceptable answers would have been Mamma Mia, Girls, 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 Hair.
Yes.
Moulin Rouge.
Yes.
And I would have accepted That Thing You Do.
Are there any... Yes, because that's what I was going to say. Are there any movies that aren't movie musicals that have an exclamation mark
loads.
At the end? All right, so go.
Movies that have exclamation marks at the end that Faster Pussycat, Kill, Kill, Kill.
Yes.
Oh, What a Lovely War?
In the middle. Oh! Oh, yes.
What a Lovely War.
Oh, What a Lovely War, yeah.
So Long, Julie Newmar, Thanks for Everything has an exclamation mark in there.
Tu Wong Fu. Thanks for Everything.
Yeah.
Love, Julie Newmar.
Yeah.
Are you sure?
Tora, Tora, Tora.
Good. Good call. Well done. Okay. So, now we're in trivia mode. It's probably a good time to have your readers' questions that you've been sending in all week via Twitter. Here's a good one from @DavidStreet76, who asks, what are your favourite uses of sound? Sound. Mine would be the Icarus distress call from Sunshine. That's David Street's, not mine.
I just watched that last night.
In preparation for this, or just...
No, just in general.
You were Chris Evansing up for Captain America...
I couldn't comment on that.
He takes his shirt off.
He is the greatest thing in that film by some distance. He's absolutely fantastic in it.
Yeah.
That sounded to me like it might have been from some kind of Star Wars.
Well, the ones that everyone's going to list off are things like, you know, Star Wars has got loads. Chewie, Darth Vader's voice, but obviously his breathing. Mm. The lightsabers we just heard.
TIE Fighter.
Yeah, exactly. There's just so much. And it did win Oscars for it. So good for you, Mr. Star Wars.
That's a good one. I like the T-Rex in Jurassic Park, and I discovered that there was a sort of composite of animal noises. Do you know which animals they used?
Isn't there something like a goose in there? There's something really unlikely.
A goose, an aardvark, an irate hedgehog.
Yeah, do you know?
Yeah,
which
I do. Yeah. They used a whale blow for the kind of breathing, and I think it was a combination of tiger, alligator, baby elephant, all kind of mixed together. And they kind of synthesized into this big reptilian roar.
I've mentioned this already, but in the trailer breakdown for the Godzilla trailer that we all know and love, you see Gareth Edwards, the director, explain how they do the Godzilla kind of roar. That's a musical approximation, though I say so myself, where essentially somebody way back when had this massive double bass, a leather glove, and not oil, but that sort of material, and then put this leather glove and pushed it down the strings of a double bass, and that gave the that has now become so identifiable with it. But seeing him act it out is pretty awesome.
I'm a big fan, actually, of the alien sort of weird trumpet in The War of the Worlds, the Spielberg War of the Worlds.
Yes.
Really freaky.
Very scary.
Really freaky. But just sort of in terms of sound design and using sound to create a kind of a weird hybrid score, the mm-hmm. beginning of Once Upon a Time in the West.
Yes, absolutely.
Has just astonishing kind of virtuosity, I suppose, in the way that, you know, you hear the kind of the creaking of the water tank in the background, and the floorboards moving, and everything kind of coming together to form this kind of weird symphony of tension.
I love it when action sequences play out to sounds. Bullet, for example, the roaring of the engines. And Jack Reach did that recently, a really nice car chase that was soundtracked almost entirely by the sounds of the cars roaring and screeching and braking. I really like that sort of sound. I love when directors drop out music and dialogue and focus on sounds. The end of Alien is great for that. And you're talking about Jurassic Park, not just a T-Rex roar, but the...
Is that so how good. They did it? They got people into a podcast booth and just...
banged on the desk.
Well, it's an approximation.
No, I thought it was really good.
You think it was good? I'll do it again. You can't see that, but Phil's glass of water just made a concentric circle.
No, to be fair, to do that, as we all know, you would need to string a double bass string underneath the desk and twang it to get that water effect.
The best thing about that, well-worn anecdote from Steven Spielberg about how they came up with the concentric circles in the water, is that he was listening to Earth, Wind & Fire in his car. He was driving along in his car and listening to Earth, Wind & Fire at full volume. Earth, Wind & Fire.
He is Steven Spielberg. He can listen to whatever the heck he likes.
That's amazing.
I'd also like to just put in a quick mention for Star Trek, because when David Strait here mentioned the Icarus distress call, it just reminded me of the sounds of the USS Kelvin at the beginning of J.J. Abrams' Star Trek. Mm-hmm. I think that's really good. And that's another example of kind of what you were talking about with that sound, that ping sound, kind of replacing music in that sequence, or linking in the music.
I also love the way that Michelle Hazanavicius used sound in a couple of sequences in The Artist. It was really nice, that dream sequence that he has where he puts a glass down the table and suddenly it makes a noise, and suddenly he realises everything's making a noise. That was really, really, really nice. And yes, screw it, it's me, it's the podcast, I'm going to mention Sam Raimi and Evil Dead, which has this wonderful...
What?
Yeah, the first two especially, which has this wonderful omnipresent wind blowing throughout the movie. It's always outside. It's always there. It's a presence in the movie, which I love.
We mentioned it before, but the Transformers transforming super that we love. Star Trek, Beam Up, Indy's Whip, Proton Pack. We have Terry Gilliam in a special extended interview where he tells us which footballers involved with the secret tournament Nike adverts in the early 2000s were arseholes or not arseholes. So that's fun. You need to listen to that. It's the podcast before this one. But anyway, I mention him because the coconuts and the Holy Grail.
I have played with those coconuts. They still have the coconut halves at Dune Castle near Stirling. And if you ask them nicely, they will lend you the coconut halves to run around with.
No.
Yeah.
That's great. Race.
That's good trivia.
For realsies?
For realsies.
Anyone got a favourite Wilhelm scream?
Yeah, I mean, I've got the great one, which is in Lord of the Rings. There is one in every film, but there's a great one off the battlements, I think, at Dol Guldur, I think. Mm.
If I'm honest, I'm getting a little fed up with the Wilhelm scream. It's happening a bit too much for my liking, and it's happening sometimes in scenes that it doesn't belong in.
Yeah, like 12 Years a Slave. It was just,
that was weird.
That was really weird.
Really took me out of the movie. Next question is from At the Carl Jackson. Lee Carl Jackson. Lee Carl Jackson has tweeted into us.
Wow.
Can you believe it? He says, would you rather watch the Chuck Norris or Steven Seagal back catalogues?
Oi.
I have a quiz alert for you.
Okay. Can I just say that Nick DeSemme is on here? Nick has written features in the magazine on both Chuck Norris and Steven Seagal. So he's kind of like the expert. So it's a shame he can't be here, but maybe it's a good thing.
Maybe it's a good thing.
He just corrected us.
He knows too much.
He knows too much.
The quiz I want to play is, can you tell which person appeared in which film?
Okay.
Chuck Norris or Steven Seagal?
Okay.
I'm going to name the movie. You just have to guess.
Mm-hmm.
Or remember.
Yeah.
I will also be sneaking in other action movie stars' movie names. Just a couple of them. And you have to call bullshit if it's neither Chuck Norris or Steven Seagal. Okay. So
why don't you play along at home?
Play along at home.
Get a pen and a piece of paper.
What's the prize?
A hug. The Hitman.
That's Chuck Norris.
Correct. Hero and the Terror.
Chuck Norris.
That is Chuck Norris.
That's Chuck Norris.
The Cutter.
Oh. Seagal.
No.
Bullshit.
Chuck Norris.
Ah! Same thing.
You know the answer to this. The Glimmer Man.
Steven Seagal. See, he started off with three Chuck Norris.
Yeah, he did.
I wasn't expecting that.
Shadow Man,
that's Skull, isn't it?
Yes.
Isn't that Nina Simone song?
Sacrifice.
Jim Broadbent.
No, that's Cuba Gooding Jr.
Really?
Yeah, really.
Okay.
Hardwired.
Hardwired.
Isn't that Jean-Claude Van Damme? No. I don't know.
I think that's Chuck Norris.
That's Val Kilmer and Cuba Gooding Jr.
Oh, come
that's
on.
That's amazing.
Isn't that amazing? This one's easy. Top Dog.
Yes. Chuck Norris.
Correct.
My brother sends me with a message. He wants people to realise that Top Dog is an underrated component part of the Norris oeuvre, and he used the word oeuvre. It's a gritty canine-based cop thriller, so everyone should hunt it down.
A gritty canine-based
cop thriller. The tagline, I was doing a bit of research and I watched the trailer as well. It doesn't look brilliant, I'll be honest. But the tagline for it is, one is smart and one is tough.
Guess which one?
You have to guess. You have to spend the whole movie guessing which one's which. And it's...
Well,
it's
we know Chuck Norris
is no
tough.
At no point clear.
So...
But is he saying that this dog is, like, smart?
Yeah.
I see.
I think so.
Smart right. Lap, yeah.
Okay.
Okay.
So that's Top Dog.
Sub-question.
Yes.
What was the name of the character Steven Seagal played in The Onion movie?
Cockpuncher.
Correct!
Wow!
Almost as good as the community's kick puncher, but with more cocks involved.
You win £5, Phil. Well done.
You've won the hug.
I think you've answered that question already.
All right, so we answered the actual question.
Yeah, sure.
That was great. Lovely, diverting quiz. I hope you all enjoyed playing along at home with your pen and paper. But would you rather watch the Chuck Norris or Steven Seagal back catalogue? What's the bloody difference, I would say, but I may be wrong on that.
I don't think I'd enjoy it either.
I wouldn't enjoy it
so
either.
So I'm going to go for Seagal because he's made fewer films, and also I think I might find them politically less obnoxious.
Okay. I don't know. It would be interesting to chart Seagal's weight over the course of the movies. I will say I'm a big, big action movie fan, but I'm not a big fan of inept action movies. And I think that by and large, I haven't watched every Chuck Norris and Steven Seagal movie, but the ones I have, I largely find awful. So I tend not to watch them. I'd probably plump for Chuck Norris just because that includes Dodgeball.
Mm-hmm.
On the other hand, Steven Seagal has made a couple of genuinely decent movies. By accident, obviously, but he happened to show up in Executive Decision, which is really good.
Mm. And Machete.
And also Under Siege, which I actually watched recently for the first time since the mid-90s and rather enjoyed.
Yes.
What you're forgetting is Chuck Norris turning into and out of a bear in Forest Warrior, which is excellent. It is some of the best subpar Tomb Raider 1 animation that you'll ever see. It's just so good.
Amazing.
Has anyone seen Chuck Norris's Good Guys Wear Black? That's
no,
so palpably not true, is it? I mean, who wears black, right?
I see he's
Luke Skywalker in Return of the Jedi.
The SS.
Yeah,
oh, okay, fair enough.
He's subversive as Chuck Norris.
Anyone seen Forced Vengeance? Because that always struck me as a very odd title.
That's a weird title.
Forced Vengeance.
Vengeance.
No, we see that. What that is basically they have two big bins in some production companies, one with nouns and one with, you know, adjectives. Yeah. And they basically just take a word out of each. And if it were, you know, if they think it sounds nice, they put them together.
Chuck Norris in
Silent Rage.
See?
Yeah, I think you are right.
Can we find another one? Martial Law, obviously.
Steven Seagal is Silent Tumescence.
Nope. Nope.
No.
Sheep Impact. Genuinely a Steven Seagal appearance.
Okay.
Sheep Impact.
Sheep Impact.
Gunshot Straight. Kill Switch.
Wow.
The Expendables 2.
Furious Googling. I could see this. I'd see a movie called Furious Googling.
I think it's Chuck. For me, it's Chuck. All the
Chuck.
Way.
Chuck for me. Let's have a show of voices because it's a radio thing. Phil. Chuck or Steven?
This is so your wheelhouse.
Can I ask my brother?
What if you watch them like in another language? Like, what if you put on the dubbing track? Would that make you happier?
Which language?
Let's Estonian. Say Mongolian.
Oh, yeah. Mongolian, definitely. It'd have to be somewhere from sort of the east, so I didn't really understand anything that was happening.
Do you go for the man with the incredibly tight trousers and the ridiculous haircut and the facial hair and the possibly iffy politics?
Mm.
Or...
The other guy with those
things.
The
guy who is gradually becoming his own country.
Are you saying that if he was on deadly ground now, he'd just plunge straight through?
He is a deadly ground. He is.
I've seen Under Siege.
I have no wish to see anymore.
That will do. And Way of the Dragon's obviously got some class. But I don't know if you'd want to go deeper into their back catalogues, would you, at this point?
That way madness lies. I think your brother went down that rabbit hole a long time ago and he hasn't come back. He's now wearing a ponytail and constantly high-kicking people during issue meetings. Yeah. So what are you saying? What are you saying?
I have to make a decision.
Yes.
Seagal.
Oh, it's 2-2.
Whoa, they didn't know there was a wrong answer.
What? How did you suddenly arrive at Seagal? Okay, so Seagal, Chuck.
Yes, because I want to see this direct-to-video film called Bells of Innocence, where he plays Matthew, an angel.
That's good. Who then presumably kicks the head of Satan?
Seagal.
Seagal. Yeah. And I'll go for Chuck Norris.
Wait, so is it two against two?
It's two against two.
Well, should I? Do you think we should ask Nick?
No, let's ask the readers. Not the readers.
Okay.
Let's ask the listeners. What do you think? Send us in emails, Twitters, Facebookies, things, and let us know. Do you think it's Chuck Norris or Steven Seagal? Now, because we wasted way too much time on this, let's go to a question from Wesley Etienne. Nice name. If you put the past 15 years of Best Actor and Best Actress Oscar winners in The Hunger Games, who would win? We tackle the highbrow subjects here on the Empire podcast.
I feel like I know this.
Should we list? Do we have a list, by the way? Should we probably list the 15 winners?
No. That would take too long. That'd be 30 people.
You just say it very quickly.
No. Anyway, I feel like I have the answer to this. Okay. I feel like out of the guys, I mean, admittedly, Sean Penn's going to put up a fight, but the winner is probably going to be Daniel Day-Lewis. I mean, if you remember in Fight Club, they were talking about you'd want to fight Lincoln. He's kind of rangy. He's got those big long arms. I feel like he's going to win the guys. Also, he's won Best Actor twice, so that's got to stand him in good stead. In the ladies, now obviously we have we have some really strong challenges there. Hilary Swank, we know she can box. Jennifer Lawrence has won the Hunger Games twice. But ain't nobody going to unseat Meryl Streep. Meryl Streep goes into that to win. I feel like she's going to triumph even over Daniel Day-Lewis. I call her as the winner.
I feel Meryl Streep and Daniel Day-Lewis might win through subterfuge. They might gradually, in a sort of battle royale situation, they might start killing people and assuming their identities and then befriending their rivals. Yeah. And then they're all like, hey, why is Matthew McConaughey being so cool with me?
Don't underestimate them. They've got the physical prowess.
Here's the thing about Day-Lewis, right? He's going to get there a year ahead of everyone else.
Yeah.
And he's just going to become a tree.
Yeah.
And he's going to make all his own weapons and shit. And
he's going to be the Peter in this situation.
And he's going to draw on probably his Mohican experience, isn't he?
Exactly.
We
know
like
he can live rough.
Tomahawking, a mofo.
Phil, I thought you were going to go for Roberto Benigni.
No, I was actually going to go for Adrian Brody, but I was thinking again.
I agree with Daniel Day-Lewis because, you know, his left hook is as good as his left foot. Am I right?
Am I right?
Yeah, no, not a way. And also, I would suggest that Tom Hanks has a great 1-2 punch.
Hey, see what you did there.
You see? Yeah. Because one year he won an Oscar and then the next year he won an Oscar.
So it's like a 1-2 punch?
So it's like a 1-2 punch. So
it's like a combination?
No.
Hello?
That's good. That's good. Colin Firth. Colin, we love your national treasure, but he's going down.
Yeah, he's totally. He's out of there.
Sean Desjardins, he's out there.
He's 2 feet as well.
McConaughey, yeah, I don't know. I think in a bongo situation, in a bongo off.
He's got a great all right hook.
Absolutely.
The same shitty joke in two different ways. Ali Plum here at the house.
And one's really connected. I
didn't like it first time. Really loved it.
Just repetition. That's the key to comedy with me. Russell Crowe. He will destroy
everyone.
He's
a tiny wee little man. He's never going
to you? I dare. Russell, if you're listening, mate, come into the pod booth and you say that, Helen. You say it to his tiny little face. And watch his little kiwi face drop.
I know he's there. I know he's tough. I just feel like Daniel Day-Lewis could probably take it from him.
I would be intimidated to death by Russell Crowe.
Also, close range, he wins. Long range, lobbing phones at people left, right and centre.
Where are you going to get a phone from in the arena?
Jeff Bridges, by the way, will just completely refuse to play and be sitting somewhere on a log.
He'll be levitating above everyone.
I think we should genuinely try and make this happen.
This is an awesome idea.
Yeah, a brilliant idea. Okay, I'll list the best actress winners of the last 15 years. Hilary Swank, she's not that bad. Julia Roberts, Halle Berry, Nicole Kidman, Charlize Theron.
Ooh, tough.
Hilary Swank again. Reese, she could do a lot of damage with her spoon. Imagine if she had a knife. Helen Mirren,
Helen Mirren. You would not discount Helen Mirren. I'm not discounting her. I really am not.
Marion Cotillard as Nails, anyone?
Hey.
Hey.
No, that was terrible.
No.
Kate Winslet. Kate, not
no.
lose.
Kate okay. wins it.
Yes.
There you go.
Sandra Bullock.
Tough, I think. But I think she'd ally herself with Meryl pretty early on. I really do. I think those two would team up.
Natalie Portman.
Too tiny.
Meryl Streep. Her versatility. It is unparalleled.
Have you seen her with a bow? It's honestly incredible. And her spear throwing. I mean, you haven't seen the released film that I've seen, but wow.
It is good.
Yeah.
It is good. The hard R cut of It's Complicated is extraordinary. Jennifer Lawrence and Cate Blanchett. For me, it's got to be Jennifer Lawrence. She's won it twice. Honestly, I just think she would kick everyone's ass.
But she's too nice to kick everyone's ass. She'd team up with Sandy and Meryl.
Yeah, but if you tried to kill her, she'd just fall over and then your bullet would go past her and then she'd stick you.
She's not Trinity from The
stick
Matrix.
Stick you. Look you in the eyes. So life bleeds for your body.
That's the best Meryl Streep I've ever heard.
Okay, time now for our first interview. Jonathan Glazer has only directed a couple of movies over the last decade or so, but when he does, whether it's Sexy Beast or Birth or this week's Under the Skin, it's clear that here's a man who knows just what the hell he's doing, which is reassuring. He's also, of course, one of the great commercials and music video directors of our time. We sent the brothers Dissembly and Phil and Nick along to talk to him about many interesting things. Many interesting things. Enjoy.
Jonathan Glazer, thank you so much for joining us on the Empire podcast. First question, slightly left field. Had Scarlett Johansson ever driven a van before this movie?
She had actually, because she was very confident that she'd be able to. And I remember thinking, why is she so confident? You know, it's not a straightforward thing to be able to do. And she's going to be driving on the left and stuff. But she told me once, I think she sort of did Route 66 in a Winnebago or something like that in the States, or something like that. So she had driven a big truck that was larger than the one we ended up filming in. So when she saw it, she thought it would be no trouble.
We were just saying, Nick, you've seen it recently, haven't you? And I saw it a couple of weeks ago. It's still kind of germinating and marinating around in the brain. I just wondered what you wanted people to take away from it, the experience of Under the Skin.
I respond to films where I feel involved, and I feel like there is a dialogue going on between the film and the viewer, which isn't necessarily articulated. It sort of works on a more of a kind of level of inner consciousness than, you know, it sort of bypasses the intellect, really. I like films that do that. So in that, what I've discovered is, you know, friends of mine have seen it, for instance, and have given me very different versions of the film according to what they bring to it. So I think you get from it what you take to it, in that sense that you imbue it with your own experience.
I think it's safe to say Scarlett Johansson's not done anything quite like this before. I don't think any actress has done anything quite like this before, but I guess the question is, how did that come about? Why her?
Well, we'd met a few times in the, you know, probably 3 or 4 years previously. I had a very early draft of the script, which she had read, and I hadn't sent to her, but she'd read somehow. And then she was in London, and we met. We talked about it and other things. And then we met up every year, I think, for about 4 years or so. Sometimes she'd read a most recent incarnation of the script, and sometimes she hadn't, and sometimes we didn't even talk about it. And then myself and my co-writer got to a point with the script which felt like it was what we were going to be making. We sent that to her, and then her and I spoke on the phone at some length one night. She was in New York at the time, and I was in London. And she said, "We talked about it like you might a book or something. Like you both read a book that you both had loved and were very enthusiastic about, and you were sharing that enthusiasm. And as if neither of us were involved in it, actually. Like there was no agenda involved in it. And in the way we discussed that, I kind of felt her really seeing it, understanding it, you know, and." She was connected to it. Mm. And when you detect that, you kind of understand that there's then a great chance of the rest, you know, of actually getting her to inhabit it, and which she did. So, and then we spoke, and then I went out to meet her when it looked like it was all coming together. I went out to meet her again and just went through the things that I was going to be needing her for, you know, because it's one thing really to... You need at some point to look in the whites of someone's eyes and say, this is what we're going to be doing, and these are the situations I'm going to be putting you in to know whether or not they'll achieve that, they'll commit to that. And she did that, and she never wavered from that. So
you were using hidden cameras. Mm-hmm. So a lot of the people in the film don't realise or didn't realise they were in the film at the time.
That's right.
I've seen an interview, you compared yourself to Beadle.
Yep.
Jeremy Beadle.
It's Beadle's About. It's like a dramatic version of Beadle's About.
Did you have a fake beard?
I didn't need to, really. I mean, I was sitting in the back of the van, though. We were all in the back of the van. She was driving about six people, myself and the AD, cameraman, and so on. So we're all in the back of the van, and she's and all the, and the and the hidden cameras are in place of things like air conditioning units and speed dials and stuff in the, you know, very carefully set in the, in a dashboard that was sort of made specifically for that, to look like a dashboard, but also to be a, something that we could house our cameras in. And then all of the images of them, I'm looking at all those images live in the back.
Did anyone recognise her?
There were a few people from time to time. Yeah, one of the guys who she wound her window down to and talked to on the curbside. He kind of double took and said, asked her if she was a movie star, and she was in all of her disguise, and he was kind of confused that he was even asking the question. But she poker faced brilliantly, and she said no. And he said, all right. And then she carried on talking, and that was that. But otherwise, occasionally in the street, but not often.
I have to ask, because I might not get another chance for another 10 years, but what was it like shooting that Guinness advert with the horses?
My memory of that, what was that like? It was great fun. I mean, fantastic island, because we shot that in Hawaii. And in Kauai, which is the, I think it's the northernmost one, it's where they shot Jurassic Park. It's the kind of Jurassic, I don't know what era it is, but it's, you really do feel like you're in that place. Epoch, is that the word?
Yeah.
And I remember just we were racing around the island to, you know, in anticipation of where the best waves were. So you kind of got to a beach, and then they weren't what you expected, and then you'd all get back in the cars and you'd go to another beach and so on. Difficult because you are shooting huge walls of water. I mean, and being out in it, it was a very exciting experience. And then the horses were shot. In fact, by one of us as well, the VFX people I've worked with for years, in a studio in London.
Oh wow!
Was that one of the more difficult commercials that you've been involved in?
I think it was technically the work was, yes, so it was difficult. Easy on, not easy, but they vary. There's different kinds of difficulty. So, but I mean, I think the trying to make the waves and the horses be the same thing, and it's now, when was that made? God, over 10 years. About 10 years ago, maybe more.
I think more.
So then, okay, so let's say 15 years ago. Okay. So then in that time, that would have been, you know, things weren't as, I think technically, they weren't as advanced as they are now. So it had its own problems, just because the technology wasn't quite where we needed it to be to pull that off. But they did pull it off.
Almost, Ben Kingsley was very, very late to arrive, and you were almost at the point of recasting. And did you have someone else in mind to do the C-bomb spectacular in that film?
No, there was pressure. You're right about recasting Ben, because he didn't show up. He was delayed on another film, from as I remember it. And we were filming for 2 weeks before he showed up. And it just, to be honest with you, it worked out perfectly, because he arrived as the character. He arrived he arrived as the buzzkill, really. He sort of spoiled the party. You know, it's like someone coming and turn the lights on. It was just like, oh, we were having a good time. And it worked well for that. And no, I never, I absolutely resisted any idea of recasting Ben. It was suggested, obviously, but no, I paid that no.
Did he really stay in character as Don Logan? Because I can imagine that being utterly terrifying. I was scared just watching him on the screen.
He took himself away, he lived in a house on the hill, you know? So he took himself away from what we were all doing. He definitely kept himself to himself in order to be able to kind of achieve what he did.
I've got one final question. It's a highbrow one. You directed Jamiroquai doing the virtual insanity music video.
Yep.
Did you try the hat on?
Oh, that's a, no. Do you know what? I didn't. No. I wouldn't. I think it stuck to his head. I couldn't get it.
It's like a Lego. Just smells on.
Jonathan Glazer, thank you so much for taking the
thank
time
you very
to
much
talk to us.
Indeed,
and I hope it's only going to be 10 years till the next time.
Thank you.
Congratulations on an amazing piece of work.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Thank you. Cheers.
Hello, I've got some casting rumours.
Hooray!
Yeah, I know how much you love those. First of all, the omnipresent, the eternal casting cycle continues for Star Wars Episode 7. I honestly feel like even when the film is actually cast, these casting rumour stories will continue.
Let me guess.
Okay.
Seagal and Norris.
Oh, so close. These are rumours for what is apparently a leading role in the film. The current story, the current reports suggest that the focus is moving away from the offspring of Han, Luke and Leia and towards new Jedi apprentices. And some of the names in contention are reportedly John Boyega from, of course, Attack the Block, Ed Spilliers, recently seen in Downton Abbey, Matthew James Thomas, who appeared in a small role in Billy Elliot, and Ray Fisher, who I haven't seen in anything. Jesse Plemons' name has once again come up. He is, of course, the guy from Friday Night Lights and most recently Breaking Bad. He's been rumored now for quite some time, and unusually, JJ has actually confirmed that his name is one in consideration. So anyway, but these are all yet names up for a young male leading role in the film. Huh.
Very interesting, because they haven't confirmed anything yet, have they? They still haven't confirmed that Ford, Fisher and Hamill are back.
Nope.
There's talk that Billy Dee Williams might be back as Lando as well.
Yep.
I hope Peter Mayhew returns as Chewbacca. And they still haven't confirmed even Anthony Daniels, their, you know, as 3PO.
No. And there's those Adam Driver as a
yeah,
villain rumours.
As a villain rumour, yeah. That hasn't been confirmed yet either. Interesting.
And they're about 2.5 months out from shooting.
About that, yeah.
Mm. Interesting.
Very interesting.
Yeah, we know nothing further at the moment, but my God, it just keeps rolling on. So, you know, as soon as anything is confirmed, we will, of course, have it for you. In the meantime, just, you know, start fan scripting it yourselves.
What do we think of those rumours? It shows that they're not looking for one type of person. They're looking for...
Well, I think they're all sort of young, handsome, I think mostly British guys, that particular crew.
That's a good point.
You know, so that's a little bit of a type. But apart from that, it's hard to say. We just don't know enough. There have been rumours that these films are going to have something more of a female lead than previous Star Wars efforts, but that hasn't, you know, been confirmed either. And it would appear that if there is a female lead, that they've either zeroed in on her a little bit more exactly, or they're keeping it very, very under wraps.
We know that Imogen Poots did not get the role because she bluntly, as you'll hear in the upcoming interview, said, no, they haven't contacted me. Radio silence.
Doesn't mean she hasn't got it.
Well, they just arrive sometimes, on her door and say...
No, honestly, sometimes you don't get a... You know, you do an interview and you think, oh, that went badly, and then you don't hear for ages, and then...
You're working for Empire.
Yeah, and then they go, hang on... What are you doing here? Why are you hosting a podcast? We got rid of you years ago. And you go, ha, 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 and then you kill people. Doesn't that...
I mean, that's how I do it.
Experience. It's my, what? What?
It's a blood-spattered CV.
Oh, God. I saw someone last night, Devin Faraci, on Twitter, who was saying that he's surprised with 2 months to go that they haven't confirmed anything yet. But he says that J.J. Abrams can be notoriously indecisive when it comes to things like this. But I would say... cut him a little bit of slack. This is the biggest casting decision I imagine anyone's had to make in a movie for a long, long time. And, you know, they got possibly the last one wrong in Star Wars with Hayden Christensen as Anakin. So I applaud the guy going over his options and seeing everyone and going through every possible possibility.
He got Star Trek right for me. I didn't feel like there was anything where he went, woof, that was a blooper. And that was with established characters. So these are new people he's creating, we're presuming here. So, you know, whatever works.
Absolutely.
Any of the Super 8 crew been rumoured in the younger roles?
You know, not that I can think of yet, no. Not even Elle Fanning, who you might kind of expect to be in the mix. You know, if Saoirse Ronan's getting a call, you'd kind of expect Elle Fanning to get a call.
Elle Fanning's great as well.
She is, yeah. We'll be seeing much more of her in Maleficent later this year. But, but again, I mean, maybe that is because they have, you know, the people they've locked down on, they've managed to keep secret. Who knows?
The Cloverfield monster.
Yeah, he's in.
Yeah?
I think
in talks.
Yeah. Wrecking Coruscant. Can you imagine, though, if you were actually cast... If he cast you and you can't tell anyone, you can't say anything to anyone for like a month.
It's tough. I mean,
what?
I imagine.
Who are you playing, Ali?
Darth Quizzim.
Quizzim.
Darth Quizzim. Darth. Okay. What else you got, Helen? You got another casting rumor?
Yeah, just another casting rumor story. It's so we now have the Fantastic Four themselves. In the very young shape of Miles Teller, Kate Mara, Michael B. Jordan and Jamie Bell. Now, of course, the search begins for an enemy, a nemesis. And they're looking, of course, at Doctor Doom. And apparently the names in the mix are Toby Kebbell, Eddie Redmayne, Sam Riley and Donald Gleeson. Three Brits and an Irishman walked into a bar and one of them got metal on his face. But we don't know who. So
a typical Friday night.
You know it. I think, I mean, the casting rumours last time about Fantastic Four were pretty much on the money. They, you know, those names had been rumoured before they were confirmed. So it's reasonable to assume that it might well be one of those four. I mean, Donald Gleeson, you're about to see him very soon play a really creepy role in Calvary opposite his dad. Toby Kebbell is kind of a pretty dark role in the upcoming Dawn of the Planet of the Apes. Eddie Redmayne, isn't he kind of a bad guy in Jupiter Ascending? He's certainly at the very least an ambiguous guy in Jupiter Ascending. Mm-hmm. And Sam Riley can do, you know, bad without even breaking a sweat. And indeed good. So, yeah, they would all seem like possibilities.
Mr. Gleason would be my pick, only because I interviewed him and he's really fun.
Maybe they could cast all four of them in a sort of I'm Not There kind of way.
Oh,
but,
wow.
You know, I'd like my Doctor Doom for once to keep his mask on.
Well, I mean, I guess it's similar to what they did with the last Fantastic Four film, where they also cast an extremely handsome gentleman and then had him go all metally halfway through. I imagine they're planning something similar here.
Alistair.
My new story involves animation. The Lego Movie has a sequel. It was announced, actually, the sequel to the Lego Movie, before the first movie had even hit cinemas and blown everyone's minds and made approximately $361 million it's earned so far. Anyway, so the writers were already announced. They are Jared Stern and Michelle Morgan. Worryingly, Jared Stern is the person who wrote The Internship. Now, Lord and Miller, they are the makers of The Lego Movie and 21 Jump Street and a bunch of other great stuff, Cloudy with a Chance of Meatballs. We love them. They are on as producers here, which is a similar role that they played in Cloudy with a Chance of Meatballs 2, which is a surprise success, certainly amongst us in the Empire office. We're fans of that pun-filled masterclass. So this one is going to be directed by the editor and animation supervisor of The Lego Movie, Chris McKay, who has also worked on Robot Chicken and a couple of other things. So it feels to me like it's another Cloudy with a Chance of Meatballs 2, where they take the animation supervisors and then give them a bump up, give them their chance to shine, and they'll have all the sensibility required to get this incredibly insane world. It's, I think, to replicate it would be impossible. It would be like saying, oh, there's Scott Pilgrim, here's another one. You know,
yeah.
You can't just do that again. So I love that they've gone in-house rather than bringing somebody else in.
And I think it is very much what they did with Cloudy, because I think they were willing to make the 22 Jump Street, that sequel, because a live-action sequel takes a little bit less time from their point of view than an animation sequel. Where, you know, this one has a release date for, I think, 2017, so that's a three-year process. Whereas this way they can still be involved in that, still have a hand in it, but also do other things in the meantime, which is pretty cool for Lord and Miller. Because quite frankly, the more Lord and Miller films they can make, the better for all of us.
I would like them to be some sort of Katzenberg-like studio supervisors for Warner's. And obviously Cloudy was a Sony picture, but you know, Warner's doing really well right now, so with their animation, so it'd be good to see what else they can do.
Well, exactly. They're on this sort of Warner's brain trust, aren't they? So that's got to be a good sign.
Mm.
I've got a couple of quick stories, but I mean, there's really no question about what the week's major story is outside of the world of cinema. It's this one. Kelly Brooks' ex-Gladiator boyfriend crashes a van full of dead badgers. and I can't really expand on that because I don't know the details. But
we don't need to know the details.
We don't think we need to know the details.
It's pretty obvious.
I'm sorry for the badgers involved. I'm sorry for Kelly Brook. I'm sorry for everyone that might have been near that scene. But I, back to movies, wanted to just touch on a couple of things. First of all, Wes Anderson, his new movie, The Grand Budapest Hotel.
Mm-hmm.
close to my heart, obviously, being from Budapest. It's opened really, really big. In fact, it's his biggest opening, I think, ever. It's just sneaked in ahead of Fantastic Mr. Fox by a whisker, but it's, I think, six times Moonrise Kingdom, and it's about three times Darjeeling and Bigger Than the Tenenbaums, and it's a film that seems to really connect with audiences, which is, I think, really cool because I really like it. And we reckon that the poster, the promotional, the number of kind of big names involved, the way they pushed it, the way they promoted it has been a factor. But I just thought it was worth mentioning because it's exciting. £1.53 million so far. You haven't seen it, go see it. The other thing is Fletch. This idea of a third Fletch movie. A reboot.
Segue.
Yeah, it's an interesting segue, but that's that's the kind of guy I am. Jason Sudeikis is being linked with the role of Fletch, made famous...
Formerly of this pod booth.
Made famous by this podcast, I think.
Exactly.
No one had ever heard of him before he was on our pod.
Jason Sudeikis is going to be taking over, potentially, the Chevy Chase role. The role that made Chevy Chase. It was right in his sort of mid-80s sweet spot around the National Lampoon period, where he played a... investigative journalist who gets into all manner of comedy scrapes. I think that's fair to say. doesn't win a Pulitzer Prize, but does break open some serious crime rings on the west coast of the US. And there's no director. It's a project that has germinated and bubbled around. The Weinsteins have been involved. Kevin Smith's been involved. They've had Ben Affleck, Brad Pitt, Zach Braff, Jimmy Fallon, Jason Lee, Zach Galifianakis, all kinds of people involved in this project. So it's just a step in that direction. Do we want to see another Fletch movie?
Yes, and of the people you've mentioned, Jason Sudeikis, for me, feels like the best fit for this character. I don't know much more about Fletch. I need to read the novels, but all I know of Fletch is the Chevy Chase movies. And Jason Sudeikis feels like the closest thing SNL has produced to Chevy Chase since Chevy Chase, which is a kind of ordinary guy, but he's very sardonic, very sarcastic, but he can convince as a, you know, as a journalist, as a just a normal chap, really.
But yeah, you need that sardonic twattery, really. You need to be a bit of a twat. It's funny, if anybody reads or knows Catlin Moran very well, she had a huge crush on Chevy Chase because of his role in Fletch. And because of this, I've seen Chevy Chase in this whole new light, and I didn't realise he was a sex symbol of a sort in his day. So maybe this is Jason Sudeikis' chance to be a kind of hunk.
Jason Sudeikis is a hunk.
Is he?
Yeah, kind of. Yeah, with the beard and the suit at the Oscars.
This is why we kept you away from him, isn't it?
Yeah.
When he came into the podcast.
I could have handled it.
I could have handled
it. Yeah,
that
was a problem, Helen.
I'm admiring. I'm not trying to steal him from Olivia Wilde, you know.
It reminds me of the reaction of this has been much more positive to the reaction that we saw with Ed Helms being associated with Naked Gun. So it's interesting how he's, I think, picked a better... Because Fletch isn't like anyone's masterpiece, right? So no one really minds it being remade. And who knows, it could be like 21 Jump Street, as we mentioned earlier, which was a reimagining and a new fun twist. So what if that's the hook?
Fletch has a wonderful, you know, those great songs that were tie-ins with films in the 80s and whatnot. There's a great one called Bit by Bit by Stephanie Mills, which is one of those rare songs that actually mentions the film. So some of the lyrics are actually about Fletch, which is quite...
That's good.
I quite like it.
I'd also suggest Dexter Fletcher, but I suppose too late now.
So we're saying Jason Sudeikis is trying to make Fletch happen. One interesting snippet of news, big news actually, as a matter of fact, is that the third Captain America film is going to be rivaling up against Batman versus Superman in the May 6th slot in 2016. Rivaling up against, yeah, it's a new form of kind of movie brinkmanship. Ooh. It's a massive balls-out statement from somebody. Question is who? What do you think?
Well, I think it's a massive balls-out statement from Marvel. This is bigger than Superman versus Nuclear Man. This is interesting because Marvel actually had that date first. They had May 6th, 2016. They had it staked out for untitled Marvel movie. They have a number of untitled Marvel movies scheduled for 2016 and 2017. This is the first one they've confirmed. We're obviously talking about Doctor Strange and other movies, Avengers 3 and whatnot.
There an inkling that this may be Doctor Strange's weekend?
That was the thinking. But Kevin Feige has recently said that Strange may pop up in 2017 rather than 2016. But this was Marvel's date, first of all. Then Batman vs. Superman moved on to that date. Now, I'm not under any illusions here. Batman vs. Superman is the bigger film. Potentially the bigger film. It could be a $1 billion behemoth. It could be absolutely enormous. But what Marvel have shown over the last couple of years is a growing confidence, a growing momentum, and there's a possibility Iron Man 3 became a $1 billion behemoth, that they might feel like Captain America, given that Captain America, the Winter Soldier, we've seen it, we can't officially review it yet, but it is very good, and it continues their run, their really, really good, really, really solid run. Yeah, I feel that Marvel are generating confidence and momentum with Captain America 2 leading into Avengers next year, which should be just huge, and then that will lead pretty much directly, Ant-Man will be in between, but pretty much directly into Captain America 3. Which will tie up events that happen in Captain America 2, one would imagine. So, yeah, there's clearly a new mindset for Marvel that Kevin Feige's already said, that's our date. We're not going to move from that date. That is our date. So the gauntlet has been thrown down. Will Warners move their biggest property? Because you have to feel that they will cannibalize each other, surely, if they open on the same date.
That doesn't seem to be in anyone's best interest. So
no,
I would wonder if it'll remain that way. Have we ever seen a kind of this level of brinkmanship in a summer tempo weekend? Is this the kind of thing that...
Honestly, for me, this brings back those days when I was a kid growing up reading comic books. You know, you were either Marvel or you were DC.
Yeah.
And I was a Marvel kid. and I still am in so many ways. And Yeah, this feels like it almost the reigniting the wars between Marvel and what they called their distinguished competition, because it was DC. One last thing I will say, there's been rumors recently that Chris Evans' contract as Captain America finishes after Avengers 2. This news would indicate that Marvel are already fairly confident that he's going to renew, or his contract is actually for 6 films, because I imagine he'll probably do Cap 3 and then Avengers 3 and then maybe bow out and be replaced by someone different with a different face.
The other Chris Evans.
The other Chris Evans, which would be absolutely amazing. But yeah, it's going to be very interesting to see what happens. I think if they do go head-to-head, I think Batman vs. Superman will win, but there's an enormous amount of goodwill towards Marvel movies at the moment, and I don't detect that goodwill towards Batman vs. Superman. That movie has a lot to prove, and Marvel, at the moment, are in a different area. I wouldn't say different league, but a different area, certainly. Anything else? We all good?
No, that's super, super stuff.
Time now for a second interview. Imogen Poots first made an impact in 28 Weeks Later, and since then a British actress has been carving out quite the career for herself in the likes of Cracks, Fright Night and Jane Eyre. She's got a double whammy this month. She's going to be seen this week in Car Chase Axner Need for Speed opposite Aaron Paul, and then she'll be seen in the Nick Hornby adaptation A Long Way Down about 4 suicidal types who meet on a roof and decide to have a second go at life. It also stars Aaron Paul.
And of course, Pierce Brosnan.
Bronholm.
And Toni Collette.
Toni Collette. Does she have a nickname?
No.
No.
Sorry.
Sadly. Anyway, she came in the iPod with recently to talk to Ali and Phil about that, Need for Speed, and tons of other things. Enjoy.
Right, we have here Imogen Poots in the Empire podcast. Today is Valentine's Day. This won't be going out on Valentine's Day, but today is a sad and dreary Valentine's Day.
Yes.
So hooray!
Woo!
Woo! This is in honour of... The Long Way Down or A Long Way Down?
A Long Way Down.
A Long Way Down.
That's right.
With Pierce Brosnan and Aaron Paul and Toni Collette. And it is a comedy, but it's also about suicide.
This is true.
So we will have lots of fun over the next 20 minutes.
Hope so.
Now, have you told Aaron Paul yet that you've never watched any Breaking Bad?
You know what? There have been many an occasion where people have brought up Breaking Bad and he has been there. And I've just sort of... I mean, I now have. It would be kind of criminal if I hadn't, by this point, seen some of it. But alas. Yeah. There's still time.
And same with Pierce Brosnan, never seen in the Bond films?
Absolutely have seen the Bond films. But okay. People keep asking if I'd ever do James Bond jokes to Pierce or Breaking Bad jokes to Aaron, and it's kind of like, no, that's sort of what a moron would do.
Yeah. Also, I've interviewed Pierce Brosnan, and I think he's a lovely, great guy, but he does not give me the impression that he wants to talk about Bond in any way, shape or form.
No way. But he's also such a goofball that I feel like, you know.
I get that from this film. There's a bit where you guys are in, is it Lanzarote? I think we can describe Pierce Brosnan's dance moves as the octopus.
Good. Very good.
He wibbles his arms.
Big fan. Yeah. I'd always say to him that he was doing a dad move. So if I was like, I don't know, dropped a big bag of nuts, or if I spilt some wine or coffee, it was sort of like dad move to the rescue. Yeah, just swimming in.
Yeah, he's a pro. I absolutely love him. There's no chance you happen to be an Adam and Joe radio show fan.
I could be.
You could be. Do you want to pretend to be?
Yeah.
Go for it.
I don't know. What kind of, I mean, what are we
there's not much
into
involved.
Here?
Just go along with...
He's essentially... These guys are obsessed with Pierce Brosnan, and they call him... They call him the Bronholm. And he appeared in a film called Taffin early on in his career, right, where he shouts the lines, "Well, maybe you shouldn't be living here."
Oh, wow.
You've got to see the clip. And everyone listening to this, go type in Taffin, Pierce Brosnan, "Well, maybe you shouldn't be living here," because it's an incredible piece of
cinema.
I'm
going to do that as soon as I get back to a room with...
A room.
As soon as I get back to a room, I'm going to do that.
Because, of course, we're outside right now.
We are.
In a shack.
Yep.
Also, we saw around about the time you were shooting this that Aaron Paul and Pierce Brosnan went to go to a Radiohead gig together.
Yeah, I was there. We were all there.
But you weren't in a photograph.
I know. Appalling. It was really...
They sent you to get the beers or
it
something?
That's exactly what happened. And I wasn't on stage with Tommy Walker. It was just sort of like in the background somewhere. But it was very upsetting. Well, you know, we've all got quite big faces, I think, so there's only room enough for two on that camera.
Instagram's a square, so...
Yeah, there's no room.
It gets complicated. As with everyone we seem to be interviewing these days, your first role was in Casualty.
It was. I was covered in Vaseline, and the director told me that I had to have toxic shock syndrome. Do you gentlemen know what this is?
No, talk us through it.
I mean, when I was at RADA, there was a small lesson on toxic shock syndrome, so whenever a director said, "Can you give us a toxic shock?" you're like, yeah.
Oh, gosh. Well, it's to do with... you know, it's to do with Tampax. So that's basically the start, beginning and end of the whole situation. So you're covered in Vaseline, you have a terrible time of it, and you don't have a great hairdo.
I mean, that's why I was so confused as to why my teacher was telling me...
I was going to say, can you talk us through what happened at RADA that day?
Yeah, exactly.
Well, you know, as an actor, Phil, you have to pretend, stop me if I'm getting too complicated, to be other people.
Okay.
Women.
Women are other people, Phil.
Yeah.
Okay. I'm sorry. Look, I'm sorry to break that to you, but that's undeniably true. Now, in this film, there is a Valentine's Day death pact, which sounds like a horrible horror movie, but there is a pact between your characters to not commit suicide until Valentine's Day. Today is Valentine's Day. Does that give you any way sort of the jitters?
Well, I mean, I just feel that Valentine's Day is yet another day of crazy expectations. And I don't know, I think if you're in a lovely relationship, it's like the best day in the world. But if you're sort of teetering on life... problems and wrong dark intentions, and it's a whole other situation. But today's okay, isn't it? Isn't it? Today's going to be fine, I think.
I've got a great feeling about today.
I do too. I just saw a picture of Paris Hilton, and it's just going to be great. Everything's going to be great.
100%. Now, going back to obviously not being unprofessional and asking people questions that you shouldn't, Sam Neill.
Oh, amazing. What a man.
What a man. And he has a fantastic moustache in this film. He plays your dad.
He does. He's very sexy. He's a very sexy man.
Did you tell him that?
All the time. Jurassic Park, sexy. Sam Neill as my dad.
Did you say really all of those words?
Yes.
Jurassic Park, sexy. Yes. Sam Neill as my dad.
Dinosaurs, awesome. He actually named a pig Poots. He has pigs and he has a winery. He has a vineyard. And that happened.
He named one of his pigs Poots for
that's
you?
Charming.
That's a compliment.
It is.
Of sorts, I guess.
I get kind of updates like I've adopted an animal.
That's such a good move. Yeah. What a great line.
It is.
I'm gonna name a pig after you.
Yeah.
Oh. And what happens if he presents you with like Poots bacon at some point?
Ah, that's a good call.
How attached can you get to this pig?
Well, I don't eat bacon.
Okay.
But I'd have to send it back.
Mm.
And you know, he obviously isn't from England, and he's doing a very English accent.
He is.
Were you saying no? You need to be a bit more like this. Well, was there any of that? Because I just totally bought it. He totally
had it down. No, he's very, very Kiwi, but he was actually also studying to do Peaky Blinders. So he kept, my dad's Northern Irish, and he kept sort of being like, I imagine if I talk like this to me in the radio. That's really bad, actually. It's a really bad idea to even do that. But he would constantly check in.
Regret nothing.
Right, regret nothing.
I'm absolutely storming you with questions here, but in the poster, and the bus stop poster in particular, of the awkward moment, there's you sitting on a sofa with the lads.
Yes.
Zack Attack and the gang. And you've got your PS3 controller in hand.
Yeah.
And I was wondering whether that was you just holding it as if you knew what it was.
Or if it's photoshopped in.
Or whether it's photoshopped in, or if you are indeed a secret gamer and you absolutely adore Call of Duty.
First time somebody asked me if I was a gamer, I thought they were implying I was a player. In terms of relationships.
Are you a baller?
One day. But I couldn't really get my head around it. You know, video games, they are what they are. I think that I have played Call of Duty one time, didn't survive very long. Lots of corners in video games, aren't there? Lots of corners. Many a direction to go in. So there's that.
I don't think there's been a truer word ever said. There are a lot of corners
really
in computer games.
Really, really, they keep on coming. Great, great art form. But I don't know. Yeah, I think that was Photoshop. Actually, no, I did hold it for a bit, I think. Sort of an odd angle, but posters like that are always sort of slightly off kilter.
It's all lies, really, isn't it?
Just a bit.
Mm. And there is a great advert with Harrison Ford pretending to play a computer game. And the light isn't even on.
Oh.
It's quite special. That's the second thing you need to watch when you get home.
Okay. Making a mental note.
Yeah, PS3, right. Harrison Ford. Now, when it comes to being in King of Cups, which is a different film entirely.
Knight of Cups. Yeah.
Throwing it out. King of Cups. He needs to rename it.
But that sounds like a porno, King of Cups, isn't it?
Does it?
I don't know, does it?
I'm going to say yes.
Great.
Good. Speaking of porno, didn't you have an interview with Imogen once? You asked for the look of love.
I did. We were reminiscing on meeting on in the box where you shot the look of love.
That's right.
And I asked you what your porno name would be, and your answer was, I don't know if you remember.
Was it a pet?
No. You just said Imogen Poots. But then you know, combining the first pet with the name of your first house, is that how it works?
And oh, then, really?
I think so. And you combine the two, but you had
Crumpet.
You had a rabbit called, yes.
Crumpet, yeah.
Crumpet.
Well, shouldn't it be your first name combined with the name of your pig? And then you
yeah.
do
Image
have
of Pigs, that's true. Yeah, that's good. Sam Neill's pig and your first name. That's good stuff, guys.
That's what we've learned. I was wondering whether you'd spoken to Terrence Malick and said, look, can you absolutely promise me you're not going to cut me down to 5 seconds? Please, I'm begging
you. Or in the movie at all. I mean, you don't know. You like turn up to work and you really don't know. But that's sort of part of the magic of making one of his films, I suppose. I don't know. It'll be interesting to see. It'll be really interesting to see. But who knows? But you just got to have a great time when you're there, and then...
Can you tell us what a Knight of Cup is?
Absolutely no idea. Nobody really knows what's going on. So let's maintain the enigma, guys. Let's keep it
did you just get
surreal.
Did you just get pages of script, or did you get the whole script? Or did you get...
Sometimes it was...
Descriptions of script.
Sometimes it could be one thing, and other times it could be neither of those things, you know?
What's the third thing?
He just walks in and says, Toxic Shock, go.
You missed that class at Ryder. Where's Ali?
Wow, that would be really great if that happened.
Ask him next time. This book is based on a book.
Yes.
A Long Way Down is based on a book called A Long Way Down.
That's right.
And it's by Nick Hornby. And of course, everyone who has a soul has seen and loved Nick Hornby's, what then became a Chicago set version of Nick Hornby's High Fidelity.
Mm-hmm.
My
mm-hmm.
question, I'm getting to it, is... Do you often make mixtapes? And if you do, is there a particular song that you find yourself putting on it a lot?
Yes. Voxtrot, The Start of Something. Know that song?
I do know that song.
Yeah, that's a great song. Also, Loverman, Little Jerry Williams.
I'm not familiar with Little Jerry's Irv.
It's still time. And probably something like Cher, don't know.
The Shoop Shoop song?
Possibly.
Okay. Well, now we know.
Mm. Yeah.
I love that.
It's good.
Filth, which we thoroughly enjoyed, had a couple of earworms in it. The David Soul
it did.
Track, mm-hmm. Silver Lady.
Yeah.
Which I hadn't really heard before.
That was an amazing soundtrack. Yeah.
And the trailer is very Scissor Sisters-y with, is it Filthy Naughty? Is that the track?
Oh,
I can't remember.
Because you're filthy.
Yes, yeah, gorgeous. Yes, yeah. Filthy Gorgeous. Did you get those stuck in your head? Did you get the David Soul? Had you come across that?
I had come across that. But I was not expecting the woman in the back of the car to suddenly sit up and give a rendition of it. It was so good. The soundtrack to that film was amazing. Also, the animation at the end of it. Did you like that?
Yes.
With the pigs and things?
Yes.
Pigs.
Pootsie was there, yeah. the old Pootinator had a cameo.
That's what happened the other day. I was actually, I don't know why, I was on a treadmill. And this guy came over and just shouted, Pooda! He was Australian.
Pooda!
And everyone looked around. And it was kind of embarrassing. Who does that? I mean, it's bad enough. Do we really need to make it worse?
Pooda.
Pooda!
Well, you know, I sympathise. My surname is Plum, and I get that a lot.
Oh, is it?
Plama. Not from Aussies.
Plama. That's good. You're sort of like a character from...
Cluedo. Yes, Cluedo. That is correct.
Sorry.
Welcome to my most of my childhood. not even slightly a joke. I also wanted to ask about, in the film, the gang, I'm insisting you're a gang, kind of lie to the press for reasons which I'll leave to people who've watched the film or will watch the film, that you saw an angel, and it is said that the angel looks like Matt Damon.
Yes.
And he's naked.
Yes.
Have you, by any chance, ever met Matt Damon? Are you worried that you might burst into giggly fits if you do see him?
I would love to meet Matt Damon. I have not met Matt Damon. But there's also that brilliant Sarah Silverman with Matt Damon, and it's
oh yeah,
you know it.
We can say it.
Fucking Matt Damon.
Yeah, fucking Matt Damon.
So I feel like he gets a lot of love from many different mediums.
I happened to be at the Monuments Men premiere recently. Hello, and Matt Damon obviously was on the red carpet, and all he gets is people shouting Matt Damon. All of the red carpet had that.
Gosh, both names. You think they just go for sort of one or the other? But it's kind of. Wow.
It comes as a package.
That's amazing.
Have you been on a red carpet and heard someone go, Pooza!
No,
and what would you do if you did?
I would run over with open arms.
Oh.
Absolutely. Or wipe them out, either one.
Or both.
Yeah.
Open arms and then...
Double whammy. Yes.
No, you just do a clothesline. And...
Matt Damon does an impression of Matthew McConaughey, which is kind of a global phenomenon. And
oh,
I think Matthew,
have you not seen it?
It's
no,
very.
Gosh. Okay, third thing
third
to look
thing.
At. Yes.
Okay. Should we write a list?
Yes.
Do you want to write these down?
I genuinely will write a list.
Do you ever do sound effects and things like this, like the sound of a pen writing something down?
Where were we? What? Yes. I was going to ask, you work with Christopher Walken, a man that is often impersonated, rarely well. Do you have a Christopher Walken impression in your locker?
Well, let's have a look. So he used to say to me things like, he called me Stinker. I've got Pooter and Stinker.
Pooter and Stinker?
Really.
They seem somehow
nice.
Connected.
And there's a pig. I'm trying to think, he sort of would say stuff like, if he was practicing with the cello in that film, and he'd say like, you know, my hands, they don't work in the, like they used to. That's the best thing.
He veered into Woody Allen just right at the end.
He did.
He just took a right-hand turn.
That's probably from the Annie Hall moment, sort of still.
All I can ever do is two mice.
That's good.
But even then, it's slightly crap.
I just like watching people's faces when they do a Christopher Walken impression and what happens to it.
It's difficult to communicate over a podcast, but it's very gurney.
It is.
I wanted to ask you about a film that I saw a couple of years back, years back. Ridley Scott's daughter, Jordan, directed it, Cracks.
About a bunch of women.
About a bunch of girls at school.
Yeah.
Well, that was the pitch, I guess. It's about a bunch of women.
It's a bunch of women.
It's called
Do
Cracks.
You want a part? Tell me your schooling was nothing like that whatsoever.
There weren't pinafores like that. No, it was nothing like Cracks. I think it's all right. I think it's like, although I was reminded yesterday by my brother, apparently I once put a note on a girl's pinny. So there was one pinny and it said, your pinny stinks. But that's sort of Cracks behaviour, I think. You know, well, deadly.
You did that to someone?
Yes.
Unbelievable.
I know.
Unbelievable.
You're a nice stinker.
Yeah.
I can't imagine you doing that to Pierce Brosnan's suit. You're a stinker, Pierce.
Your suit stinks.
And then misspell Pierce. Oh, that would really he'd hate that. Now I've got to ask you, how much can you not tell us about your Star Wars audition?
Oh, Star Wars audition. I had to pretend there was a suitcase, and you had to sort of unpack objects from a suitcase.
I mean, that was at RADA too. That was the other lesson.
Oh, that was
the Star Wars suitcase.
Yeah. That's
You just had to unpack things from a box.
It was very long because you have to then think about what kind of suitcase have you got? What kind of suitcase has your character gone for? All of this was a little bit overwhelming. Probably why not going to be part of the Star Wars.
They said, I'm sorry, your bag unpacking is ridiculous.
Yeah, I think that's what they were looking for. It's like, what do you go for first? You know what I mean?
And you were using you know, comedy sound effects. And
absolutely.
Boing!
Yeah, all that jazz.
Whoa! I'm just imagining how I'd behave if I'm one of J.J. Abrams.
Well, no, you can do like a... one of them. But then why would you be pouring water into your suitcase? Because you're nuts.
There has to be a word for...
That's the...
Did you make the mistake of using like a Wes Anderson-y old sort of suitcase?
In my mind,
very much a sci-fi suitcase?
It was all, very kind of monochrome and no. But I think that is why. What did you bring to your audition in your suitcase? That's the question.
Oh, I see.
You know? Blimey,
is that the most unusual task that you've been given in an audition?
No, I've had to give birth once.
No.
Not for real, but...
I mean, that would be an incredible ask. We'll have your CV and could you make sure that you're about 9 months pregnant? Oh, I see you in your second trimester. I'm afraid the part's not yours.
So you gave birth and then was that followed by a scene of cocaine abuse in a hospital maternity ward?
Oh!
A la Look of
that
Love.
That actually wasn't to do with Look of Love, but I also... That was
Need for Speed, wasn't it?
Need for Speed, yeah. That. That's one of the Need for Speed. Oh, my God. No, Need for Speed, no audition. No driver's license either.
Nice.
Yeah.
I'm with you. I also don't have a driver's license.
It's all right. It's going to be okay.
It's quite thrilling.
It is thrilling. It's a little bit embarrassing when you're behind the wheel of a Mustang car, not horse, but it's fine. It'll be okay. I have faith.
A Mustang.
Yeah.
They've made the film.
It's done now.
It worked out.
I think so.
I love that you didn't have a driver's license and you were Need for Speed. Just so
deliciously
wonderful.
Ironic. Yeah.
So wonderful.
It's kind of amazing.
I want to know more about this birth that you had.
I think I just sort of got down and did it.
And was it for a film that you can mention? Or?
I think it was when I was... I can't remember what it was for, actually. I was very young. Not very young. Sort of middle-aged child actor. I was about 15 or 16 and just sort of got down and did it. Got up, went home. Mum was like, how was it? I was like, it's all right. So I'm trying to think of like other auditions where you've had to do weird things. It's always a bit awkward if you're given a script and in the audition there's lots of action that takes place and you've sort of got to duck from, you know, incoming lobsters or what may happen in that kind of film.
I mean,
Need for Speed.
That's classic Terrence Malick, isn't it?
It really is.
He's just going, the lobsters are coming, get down!
Every time.
Now, going back to the gang of the four of you, have you made a planned reunion? Because I got the impression watching the film that you were best buddy old pals.
Well, we became really, really close during the film. Toni Collette is a lady who's very present in my life still. But we had a reunion just now in Berlin, and that was lovely. And it's nice. Yeah, the dynamic on screen is definitely realistic of how close we all were off screen, which is very special. But it's great to have that kind of relationship is unreal. And have it caught by a French babe on camera, which is what happened. Our director, Pascal's French.
A French babe. Oh. Yeah. I was like, really? There was a baby? Or
that's back to that audition.
What is going on?
You mentioned that you'd had the rap party for The Look of Love in the exclusive London night spot, The Box.
Uh-oh, yeah.
And I wondered, which sounded like a great night, I wondered what you did for Filth.
For Filth?
Because...
I don't think I was there, guys. I think they were still in Scotland, and I imagine there was lots of whiskey and tapeworm. But no, wasn't there for that. Wasn't invited, don't think. Hang about.
God, this is getting a bit...
That's awkward.
Sorry, guys.
So on that great note, let's wrap this up.
Okay.
Actually, I just realised we've gone over a bit, so...
Oh, we have.
Yeah, we have. We've been talking quite a lot of bollocks, so it's been a real treat. Thank you so much, Imogen.
Can I ask a last question? I just wondered what you're doing next.
Well, I'm about to go and do something, but...
Say no more.
But, yeah, I'm going to go do something, guys. That's what's going to happen.
This isn't the Peter Bogdanovich project, is it?
That is coming out at some point in the future, called Squirrels to the Nuts.
It sounds like a 70s sitcom.
I was probably informed by something 70s, seeing as Peter is from that time and is also 74 years old.
And a legend.
That's
an
right.
Absolute legend.
Absolute legend.
Yeah, I wonder whether I'll get fixed before the poster comes out. Squirrels from the Nuts, I mean, really. It sounds like a kid's film. I don't think it sounds like a 70s film at all.
Well,
do you think?
It's got a prostitute in it.
So not a kid's film, then?
Totally a kid's film.
Totally a kid's film. Yeah, okay, good. Glad we cleared that up.
Yeah.
Thank you so much.
Thanks, guys.
I can only apologise. I really can. Until next time, you're more than welcome whenever you want to walk in on a wet Valentine's Day.
Thank you so much. That means so much, guys. Thank you.
She seems like a bundle of fun.
She's a lot of fun. And as you have no doubt heard, we now need to call her. If you see her on the street, maybe I shouldn't say this, shout, Pooja! Hello, Pooja! Because she loves it. She absolutely loves people shouting Pooja at her.
But let her get off the treadmill first.
Yeah, let her get off the treadmill. That interview was in honour of A Long Way Down, which is out next week. Is that right? Next week. Yes. So we'll be talking more about that film next week.
We will indeed. We'll be talking about Need for Speed very, very soon, because it's time for reviews. And let's start with Sir not appearing in this podcast, who is, of course, the legendary Terry Gilliam, who's in danger of becoming prolific with The Serial Theorem, his second film in 4 years. Can you imagine that? Cracking Terry Gilliam podcast special, as Ali has already mentioned, is available right now for your ears and is well worth some of your time. But is the film?
This depends on your love of Terry Gilliam. He is an extraordinary human being. As you know from the podcast, he is fun and full of energy and not afraid to say what he means and get what he wants. He is a beautiful hurricane of 8 sugars in your coffee joy. And his films are nothing if they're not Terry Gilliam. This film, The Zero Theorem, couldn't be more Terry Gilliam if it tried. It is extraordinary how quickly you fit into the Terry Gilliam world. This is against bureaucracy. It's against like monotonous work. It's against modernity's all-seeing eye that's on you, and iPads and Twitter and buying things and commercialism and all that stuff that he rails against. And it's great to be back in there. The story revolves around a data processor. Wait, I know you're excited, but let's illuminate you with a little bit more detail. A data processor played by Christoph Waltz, who we're introduced to as he's tapping away on his computer. Everything in this world has a different form of technology. It's vials of liquid instead of like memory or data sticks. Screens are operated via kind of a complicated Xbox controllers. It's all joyfully imagined. He's living in this big abandoned church, and he's just processing data, waiting for the phone call. And the phone call is apparently what's going to give him the meaning of his life. Phone will ring, he'll pick it up, and it'll go, "You need to eat more cheese. That's it. Bye." He doesn't know what it is. Something will happen. He has to be home to listen for the phone call and pick it up. But he's got to go into work, and he goes into work to work for a place called Mancom. Is that right?
That's right.
And that's run by David Thewlis. He's his line manager. Brilliant, David Thewlis. He really channels Eric Idle in this. He's zany and weird and, again, full of energy. And then above him is Matt Damon, who plays management, who is the owner of this big company. He just wants to be at home. But in order to be at home, he has to take this task, which is solving the Zero Theorem. And the Zero Theorem is
proving that life is pointless. So the man who is waiting for the phone call to give him a meaning of life is challenged with proving that in reality, it's all for naught. Literally, all for naught. There's the conceit. In amongst it all is a huge amount of acting talent from all the people I've just mentioned, and Melanie Therry, who is a femme fatale who is introduced into his life, and she is just sexy. She's really sexy. She is very much shot for her looks, and she's played as this seductive beauty invades his life. And it's the story of how he comes to terms with that problem. Everyone in it is good. It is obviously shot on a shoestring. The budget problems for this are well documented. They tried to make this film 3 or 4 times, as is traditional with all Terry Gilliam movies. And, you know, we've talked about how it used to be Billy Bob Thornton, who used to be up for the main role. Coen is the name of the lead character. But despite its financial limitations, it is a fascinating visual treat. And though it is dense, to say the least, if you love Terry and you're willing to give it the time, you will get a lot out of this. This is a film that is worth investigating, and if you're into it, rewatching. It's got so much detail and love in there that it's worth a shot. That said, I can also see how it might divide people. I can see how people might think it's just a little bit too much. But for me, I bought it.
It's really interesting that the week after Wes Anderson brings out the most Wes Anderson-y film ever, Terry Gilliam brings out the most Terry Gilliam-y film ever.
It's very Brazilian, to say the least. People have been saying it's a kind of unofficial trilogy. Brazil, Zero Theorem, and
12 Monkeys.
12 Monkeys, yeah.
So it's more Brazilian than Hollywood.
Correct.
There is a lot going on, but I think that's the main thread of it. But there are kind of interesting parallels with Spike Jonze's Her in terms of, you know, future where people are bogged down in kind of the sort of burping, farting kind of morass of information and technology and ads and being bombarded with stuff and the noise. And it's a very immersive, it's probably a more immersive experience than Her. Her is maybe slightly more detached from the world, whereas Terry Gilliam just chucks you into this big bath, this big soup of binary fluorescent colours and all the rest of it. But it's just about a guy that's trying to find a human connection, I think, in common with her. It's very sort of relatable on that level, and it does have a heart. So it's not just all kind of weird, idiosyncratic Gilliamisms. It's got a heart to it as well.
Not a date movie, I would also point out. Not a date movie.
Unless your date is
Terry Gilliam.
Yes. 4 stars then for the Zero Theorem. And let's move on now to what should we do next? Should we do Under the Skin?
Yeah.
Let's do Under the Skin. All right.
Does anyone else have the urge to sing it to the tune of Under the Sea?
Under the Skin. Under the Skin.
Two different tunes going on.
Before we begin, I'm guessing not a date movie.
This is a date movie. Ali, I'm not going to lie to you. This is probably the perfect first date movie. With some form of alien.
Should you then...
Look, this is a film that Jonathan Glazer has been trying to make for a very long time, and Scarlett Johansson has been helping him with that process. You know, as I think he talked about in the interview, they met every year to talk about this part. She plays a nameless alien who you see at the beginning in a kind of a 2001 Kubrick, Arthur C. Clarke kind of birth sequence. She becomes made in this weird void, and then she comes to Earth in a kind of evil messianic capacity to prey on Scottish dudes.
Prey with an E.
He was supposed to actually like kneeling on Scottish people.
It's probably the use of the word messianic.
Depends what they like, Phil, to be fair. Let's not judge.
Exactly. Well, she drives a white van around Glasgow.
Hello!
I know, there's your warning sign. It's Scarlett Johansson.
Oh, really? Do you mean that?
Scarlett Johansson driving around basically preying on men, taking them back to this strange kind of viscous chamber where they're
like a black widow.
See what we did there.
Her red van of pain.
Taking them to this sort of viscous black goo where they are kind of their life force, their kind of insides are basically kind of processed for this alien corporation that she works from. Glazer's kind of stripped away a lot of the stuff from the Michelle Phaben short novel that explains exactly what her purpose is and what the alien kind of scheme is, and how there's a lot of corporate satire that's no longer in this. This is more of a film about seeing our world through the eyes of someone that doesn't understand, someone that doesn't really understand how humans work and can't really relate to the way that humans have empathy for one another and the way that we operate, the weirdnesses that we kind of exist with. And as the film develops, she kind of starts to, you know, be penetrated by this stuff in quite a profound way, not in a sexy way.
Okay.
She starts to take a lot of these things on, and her character kind of develops a strange contradiction, should we say, between her purpose and what she's learning from the world around her. But I guess we were talking about audio earlier, and I think this is an amazing sound design film. It's got a really, really eerie soundtrack design. Mika Levy of Mika Tuna Shapes. The sound design is astonishingly eerie. It's got very sort of stark Scottish landscapes. It's got some scenes that will stay with you for a very, very long time. It's cold and it's detached, but it's also got a lot of kind of, it kind of moved me quite profoundly. And it stays with you. There's things in it that are really, really uncomfortable to watch. There are scenes where, I won't talk about, there's a scene on a beach which plays out, it's anguish to watch it, but it, you know, it stays with you, and there's a reason why he shoots it that way. Everything kind of makes sense, but it's one of those films that just sort of immerses you, and you come out feeling kind of very differently, and it has an incredible power in that sense. I think it's the best film I've seen this year, personally. We've given it 3 stars. I would say that it's sort of, it's a little bit like the Zero Theorem. You're either going to love it or you're going to hate it. So we've sort of gone in the middle.
Yeah.
I mean, I love this movie. It has stayed with me. I would like to see it again. It's not always comfortable viewing, but it does make you feel, it does make you think differently about things. And we've given it 3 stars. Not everybody feels the way I do about it within the magazine or the world at large. So I would suggest that you go along and make up your own mind.
Indeed, because why? Because 3 stars is a recommendation, and 5 stars, which Phil would give it, is certainly a recommendation, so do go and check out Under the Skin. Now, do we feel the need for Need for Speed, or do we not feel the need for Need for Speed? Helen?
So this is obviously an adaptation of the driving game, which comes with a great strength, I would say, in terms of game adaptations, that there is no story whatsoever to adapt except for Cars Go Fast, Brum Brum. So Aaron Paul is our lead. He stars as a young kind of mechanic and driver. You know, he sort of builds racing cars as well as driving them. All seems to be going well until he gets the blame for a fatal crash and is sent off to prison. And when he comes out, in order to sort of, in an odd way, get revenge or get his life back, he enters an illegal road race and has to get across country to get to this race, while the bad guy, played by Dominic Cooper, who sent him to jail in the first place, offers people lots of money to get rid of him en route. That's more plot than you need. It's really stupid. It's so stupid.
It's more plot than I thought it would have. Yeah, I'll be honest.
It's too much plot, some would say. This is just deeply, deeply dumb. I mean, honestly, if you look at Aaron Paul, every scene he's on screen, he is 100% committed. He actually makes something out of this character. This character, you can see what's going on. He's such a good actor. It's all in his eyes, even when the dialogue is stupid. But he's surrounded by people who don't matter. And he's making decisions that make no sense. I just don't understand. And also, you know, poor Imogen Poots is stuck. I've said this before on Twitter and so on, but she is stuck with the worst written, most unconceived female character I have ever seen. Someone who in one scene will be a huge expert on cars and know everything about them, and in the next scene is being made fun of because she apparently can't drive, which I guess is technically possible, but seems, you know, startlingly unlikely. She just doesn't make any sense, you know, on hearing that the cops are looking out for Aaron Paul's character and a blonde. When she sees a cop, she panics and ducks. A blonde is not the most, you know, precise description in the world. She probably could have got away with that. Also, the idea of driving the race car that you're about to try and race cross country for 48 solid hours before racing it seems, you know, again, like an ill-conceived plan from start to finish. And
it's not ideal, no.
It's really not ideal. I don't understand basically any of the decisions that anyone takes in this film. And then the race that they're trying to get to is so spectacularly badly thought out that I was just I just couldn't get past it.
It's obviously based in a video game, so
yeah, I know. Listen, I'm not going into this looking for, you know, the tight plotting one might associate with a really well conceived thriller or something. I'm just looking for basic plot, and it doesn't really have that, and it doesn't really have the characters to support Paul and give him something to bounce off, because, you know, as we saw in Breaking Bad, you give him Bryan Cranston or something And, you know, there's absolutely no one better. He's really good here, but he's got nothing to work with. Dominic Cooper spends all his time basically sneering. Imogen Poot spends her time yo-yoing between being a total bimbo and an interesting figure. And his friends, who are played by, you know, good people, Rami Malek and people like that are in there, they just don't have anything to do. They just, you know, do a couple of stunts and then disappear. And even though the Aaron Paul's driving a race car and they're driving a truck, they somehow seem to overtake him on a regular basis so he can refuel and stuff. It doesn't make any sense. I don't understand why anybody did anything in this film. Also, the dialogue is laughable. Having said that, we had quite a lot of fun just laughing at it, not with it.
But is it funny? The important thing for me is that it needs to be amusing. We've got, you know, Beetlejuice on this film. Like, are there humours?
But there's humours like, I mean, yeah, Michael Keaton, who is the guy who's basically organised this illegal race, he's meant to be this mysterious figure and no one knows who he is, but he broadcasts his face on the internet. Mm. I mean, and he's meant to be a millionaire and have a past as a racing car driver, or so we're told, or so it's hinted. And his face is on the internet, so I'm sure somebody could put together who he is.
Presumably Imogen Poot's character can't use the internet.
Well, half the scene she would be able to, but the other half she wouldn't.
She's doing code 1 minute, and then the next minute absolutely doesn't know how to turn the machine
exactly,
on.
Exactly.
Okay.
I'm guessing the joke about her not being able to drive was included last minute, because, as we discovered in the interview, she actually cannot drive, but she did get this part. So she's playing this character. Obviously, I understand how acting works. You don't have to be the person.
Sure.
But I imagine that her actually saying, yes, yeah, so I can't do any of that driving stuff, must have come up at some point.
I remember when we figured out that thing about not having to be the person when you're acting. That was about, like, yeah, that was last month, wasn't it?
Yeah, I think, was it February? Yeah,
that's
February.
Changed my life, I'll
Wait,
be honest.
So you mean Hugh Jackman doesn't have metal claws?
No, that is true.
Oh, okay.
Oh.
All right.
No, that's true.
Oh, okay, sorry.
He does. We had them sawn off, but they've sort of grown back.
So what about the action, for example? There was a lot of hype beforehand that perhaps, unlike Fast and Furious franchise, which does quite a lot of CG stunts, that this would be mostly in camera, it would be real cars being raced for real with real drivers.
That is, I mean, most of that's true. There are a couple of really good car stunts. I'm not sure that it's no CGI. I think it's minimal CGI. But the car stunts are fine. As far as they go, there are times when it's not entirely clear which car is which in the final race. And also, I mean, again, that race just, it irritates me on so many levels, and I can't talk about it because of spoilers, but
okay, I think that says it all, to be honest. So it's not, for example, you never know, it might be a huge hit. It might
be a huge hit.
Exactly.
You can never rule out a hit in cases like this where it involves cars going broom.
Is Imogen Poot's character as thankless as Abbie Cornish's in RoboCop?
But Abbie Cornish's is bad, but there's nothing to it. Imogen Poot's is in almost every scene. And it doesn't make any sense.
Okay, so we gave Need for Speed 2 stars, which is not a recommendation. Also out this week is Irish stag do comedy The Stag, which we reviewed on last week's show ahead of its release in Ireland. It's pretty good. 3 stars for that one as well. And that's it for this week's Empire Podcast. Join us next week for more film-related fun, where we'll be joined by two manly men, men's men, men about town. First is Jack O'Connell, the fast-rising British star of Startup. And then Mr. Josh Brolin. We'll be here to talk about Jason Reitman's Labour Day and much, much more. Until then, it's goodbye from Helen.
Fare thee well.
It's goodbye from Ali.
2 more. Safety last. And them both have exclamation marks at the end.
And Mars Attacks.
And Mars Attacks, like Helen said.
It's goodbye from Phil as well.
Goodbye.
And it's goodbye from me. I'm off to pitch a new film starring Chuck Norris and Steven Seagal. Phil, give me an adjective.
Rambunctious.
Helen, give me a noun.
Badger.
Ali, give me an exclamation mark.
Bink.
Coming next year. Chuck Norris and Steven Seagal in Rambunctious Badger.
Bing.
We'll be sitting on the beach earning 20%. See you next week.